Okay, good evening, everybody. So now we're going to do the second part of this series. And tonight we're going to talk about a Rav, probably who more of you have heard about than the first one, but probably still many of you don't know all that much about him, and that is Rav Henkin, Zichrono Livracha. By show of hands, how many of you have heard of Rav Henkin and can tell me something other than his name is Rav Henkin? What can you do? So that is the wrong Rav Henkin. I mean, not the wrong Rav Henkin. That is a different Rav Henkin. That is his grandson. But we're talking about Rav Henkin Sr., whose name was Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, and not Rav Henkin Jr. The middle generation was a professor in Columbia, I believe, the one in between, maybe Columbia Law School. But Rav Henkin Jr. was Rav... What was the grandson's name? Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, I think. And his son was also a massive Talmud Chacham, and the great grandson of the original Rav Henkin, he was Rav Etam Henkin, Hashem Yikom Damo, who was Nebuch murdered by Arabs a few years ago here in Israel, and he was a rising star on the scene of on the Torah scene. He was certainly someone who was Omed the Gedula. He was going to be really, really great because he was, I think, only 29 years old. And he wrote enough that you can already see from his Sfarim that what he was working on was unbelievable, like really, really high-level stuff. So it was a very, obviously every loss is a tragic loss. That was like a tragic loss for Claudius. Well, did you see your mother?
Yes, I did.
Yes, okay, thank you. So we're talking about the Elter Zedi, right? Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. So Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin was born in Belarus in 1881. I am recording, so we're good with the recording. In Belarus in 1881, he's a descendant of Rav Chaim Volozhin. He came to America in 1922. What was going on in America in 1922? Jewishly? Anyone know what was going on in America in 1922?
Not that much.
Not that much. I mean, it was not like, you didn't have, if you drove around the five towns, you didn't see shuls on every corner, right? There was no place that was really like that. And even the places that did have shuls, mostly it wasn't Shomrei Shabbos that were davening the shuls. It was just people trying to hang on to some last remnant of Yiddishkeit that they had. He's actually buried in Beth David Cemetery in Elmont. Elmont, anyone from the five towns here? Yeah, a bunch of guys. So it's like 10-minute drive from where we live. There are so many Kivrei Tzadikim in that area. Most famously, of course, is the Kever, which is the most famous Kever in the area of the Lubavitch Rebbe, the Ayel. That's the most famous Kever there. But there are so many Kivrei Tzadikim in Queens. I did a cemetery tour last Elul with guys from my shul. What? Not Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, but Reb Moshe Soloveitchik is buried there, and the Meitzer to Eloy, and like Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, and Reb Palm, and like all the Torah Das Rosh Yeshiva, all the Wayu Rosh Yeshiva. So Reb Henkin is buried in New York also. His tombstone doesn't say anything laudatory, it just states the facts. You know, he was president of Ezra's Torah, the author of the Sefer. Nothing really, nothing like you'd expect sometimes on a tombstone for it to be extremely verbose and laudatory, not so much. He was a Talmud and a Musmach of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Who was Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer? Rav Isser Zalman was a Rosh Yeshiva in Europe first, and then here in Israel. He was the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler, and wrote a sefer called Eben HaAzel, which is a masterful sefer on the Rambam. He was also, Rav Henkin was also a musmach of Rav Baruch Ber Leibovitz, no relation, as far as I know. Unfortunately, Rav Baruch Ber was the prime Talmud of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. So much so, what was Rav Baruch Ber's relationship with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik like? They said that they asked the Brisker Rav, what's the difference? I think this is the way the story goes. They asked the Brisker Rav, what's the difference between you being a Talmud of your father, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and Rav Baruch Ber being a Talmud of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik? He said, well, when you tell me that my father said, let's say, this table is like a cow, I would start analyzing and say, well, it has four legs, like a cow has four legs. If my father were to tell Rav Baruch Ber, this table is like a cow, he would spend an hour trying to milk it, meaning like he was such a loyal Talmud of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik that anything Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said had to be 100% true. So Baruch Bar was also a genius in his own right, and he gave smicha to Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin also got smicha from the Ritvaz and the Aruch HaShulchan. So he was a very qualified rabbi. In fact, one might say he was overqualified to be a rabbi in America in 1922, because there wasn't that much of a Torah community. Rav Eliashiv used to refer to him as the Marada Asra of America. He wrote svarim that were never really that popularized. Not every library has his svarim, but more recently they became more popular because his great grandson Rav Eitam Henkin, Hashem Yikodomo, together with a big Talmud Chacham from Brooklyn, Rav Daniel Asher Kleinman, worked together on redoing Rav Henkin's svarim and publishing them, putting them together nicely and putting them out in nice volumes. And they're printed in a set called Gvuras Eliyahu, which is also a fascinating thing, that the two people that were working on it was Rav Eitam Henkin, who was a significant member of the Datilu Umi community here in Israel, meaning the Kippah Sruga community, the religious Zionist community. And that's Rav Eitam Henkin. And Rav Daniel Asher Kleinman is like a yeshivisha Brooklyn guy, meaning like he learned in Philly, and he's a big Talmud of Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. And they became best of friends because they're both geniuses. They're both rising stars in the Torah world. And sometimes Torah just has the ability to break down any language barriers that there may be, any cultural barriers, even hashkafic barriers, because they recognize in each other this greatness in Torah, so much so that when Rabbi Eitam Henkin was killed, Rabbi Kleinman wrote a very beautiful dedication and a hesped to him. So it was a very beautiful thing to see how these two rising stars, Rabbi Daniel Asher Kleinman, a young person. He's also around that age, and he's published dozens of svarim, mostly of Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky's Piskei Halacha with his own commentary on it. So it's a real testament to the Torah HaKadosha and its ability to bring people together. Rav Henkin, the one we're talking about now, the Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, was the president of Ezra's Torah organization from 1925. It's an organization that supports Talmidei Chachamim, as its name would suggest. Ezra's Torah, right? Helps Torah learners. So, but it's most famous, Ezra's Torah is most famous still today for producing a luach. If you're ever in a shul and they're like, when's the mola this month that we have to announce? So they pull out this little tiny book and they look, right? That's the Ezra's Torah luach in all likelihood. That's what people use for all the zmanim and to know what to say and what to skip and which haftorah to read and all that kind of stuff. So he was president of the organization called Ezra's Torah. Rav Henkin had many famous piskei halacha. Rav Shechter just referred to one of them yesterday. I don't remember in which shir, so I don't know if everyone heard this one or not. Rav Shechter referred to how Rav Henkin used to be very, very upset that in many yeshivas and shuls, they used to stop before Tekiyah Shofar and have a kiddush in the yeshiva. Did he say that in front of everybody? Yes, no? He said it to the... Where did he say? I think he said it to the counselors. So maybe to the whatever you call it, madrichim. So Rav Henkin was so opposed to that minhag, because he said, you have a mitzvah to do of Tekiyah Shofar. How could you stop and have a meal? How could you stop and have kiddush right before the mitzvah of Tekiyah Shofar? When I was a kid growing up, before my family moved to the Five Towns when we were in Brooklyn, this is what happened. Rosh Hashanah davening ended at like 3 o'clock because they stopped for like an hour before Tekiyah Shofar to do a kiddush. When I was learning in Keren Biavne, they did that. Yeshivas throughout the world do that. They have a kiddush before Tekiyah Shofar. Rav Henkin hated that practice, so much so that he used to make a tanai in his smicha when he would give someone smicha. It was al tanai that whatever yeshiva you lead or shul you lead does not stop and make a kiddush before Tekiyah Shofar, which is a pretty, like you would think, tanai that you don't, I don't know, ordain women or something like that. You know, like the tanai was that you don't stop and have, you know, before Tekiyah Shofar. Wild. He used to call Rav Aaron Cutler every year before Rosh Hashanah. Rav Aaron Cutler was Rosh Shiva of what famous yeshiva? BMG, the Beis Medrash Gavah of Lakewood, which at the time was like, you know, at the time Rav Aaron died, there were like 60 guys in BMG. It wasn't like, it wasn't what it is today with, I don't know how many thousands of Talmidim. In fact, Moreno Rav Shechter was a Talmud in BMG for one summer. And the Rebbetzin told me Rav Shechter was thrown out of BMG. He was expelled. So it's a good story. Rav Shechter said that when they were doing like a 50th anniversary of BMG, they were looking through their records of their alumni and they saw Herschel Shechter there. So they called him up. They said, when did you learn in BMG? So he said, when I was in ninth grade, Rav Shechter said, when he was in ninth grade, he was in the shiur in MTA of Rav Moshe David Tendler. Rav Moshe David Tendler, Zichron Levracha, you know, it was Rav Moshe Feinstein. His son-in-law was Rosh Yeshiva in YU, and at that time he was a ninth grade Rebbe in MTA. And Rabbi Moshe Tendler's brother, Rabbi Yosef Tendler, who later became the Menahel of the high school in Eretz Yisrael for many decades, was learning in the Kollel in Lakewood. And he called up his brother, and he's like, it's Shvach, we need some reinforcements, like there aren't enough guys here. So they sent boys from MTA to be Mechazek, the base Medrash, in BMG in Lakewood. That is like, that's a piece of history, no? So I don't think it was really boys from MTA. I think it was YU boys and Rav Shechter. He was a little precocious as a youngster. So they sent him. So apparently they used to be a thing that people were always making, people in the more yeshivish circles were making fun of Rav Soloveitchik, and they used to refer to him as JB. Joseph Beres, they referred to him as JB instead of referring to him as Hagon or Rav Soloveitchik Shlita, right? So they referred to him as JB. So Rav Shechter got so upset that he started referring to Rav Aaron Cutler as AK, and that's when he got the boot. He was thrown out of BMG. That was the story the Rebbetzin told me. So how did we get to BMG? So Rav Henkin used to call Rav Aaron Cutler every Erev Rosh Hashanah to wish him a Shana Tova, and he used to say, and a reminder, don't make a kiddush before the Kiddush Shofar, you know, in your yeshiva. Rav Aaron Cutler said, thank you very much, good yantiv, and of course he made a Kiddush every year before the Kiddush Shofar. Rav Henkin wrote that this is a minhag ra. Rav Gifter wrote a letter trying to object to Rav Henkin's classifying it as a minhag ra. Another famous psak that Rav Henkin had was that if a Jewish storekeeper, let's say, would sell his chametz to a non-Jew before Pesach, but then keep his store open and operating over Pesach, Rav Henkin paskin that the entire sale is invalid, and it's the whole thing is a joke, and therefore everything he has is chametz shavar lav Pesach. That was an important psak that was against Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe held that it's not necessarily chametz shavar lav Pesach. He said the guy's a ganav, because he sold all of his chametz and now he's taking it back and selling it to customers throughout Yontif. So he's a ganav, but it's not, the chametz is still kosher. You're still allowed to have the chametz after Pesach. So that was another important psak of Rav Henkin. And another famous psak of Rav Henkin, and this one I learned when I was in Palo Alto, California at my brother's house before my brother moved to San Jose, and which is, for most of you, it's the same thing anyway, right? So when I was in Palo Alto, California, I took a sefer off the shelf, and it was one of Henkin's farm. And I opened up the sefer, and in the front cover of the sefer, like over here, right, it said, Misifrei Moshe Feinstein, which means that my brother stole it from Rav Moshe Feinstein's library, which is a pretty cool thing to do. He didn't really steal it. He married Rav Moshe's great-granddaughter, and therefore he yarshined that sefer from Rav Moshe. So Rav Moshe's copy of Rav Henkin's writings is in my brother's library. I happened to pull it off the shelf. I opened up to a random page, and Rav Henkin says that when a person is davening for an amud, and this is nogeh to many of you, the Maisa, you're davening for an amud, and you're up to the bracha, bracha to Hashem, Gal Yisrael, right before Shemoneh Esrei begins. So what do? Baruch Atah Hashem, and then many people will whisper Ga'al Yisrael. Right? Rav Henkin says, Nein! That means no in Yiddish. Do not do that! You're not supposed to do that. He says, you're the Shliach Tzibur, you're supposed to say it out loud. The people are supposed to know that in order to avoid answering Amen, that they should say it along with you so they won't have to answer Amen. But they should say it word for word together with you. So Rav Henkin made a big deal about that. Supposedly Rav Chaim Kanievsky is quoted in Sefer Isha Yisrael where he says, no, the Minhag Yisrael is a good Minhag, it's okay. He shouldn't criticize this Minhag. But that's what Rav Henkin felt very strongly. Rav Henkin is most often, when you think about Rav Henkin, most often people refer to him in terms of Rav Moshe. In fact, Rav Shechter just yesterday said Rav Henkin was the Posek Hadar in America before Rav Moshe Feinstein. That's the way he's always referred to, which is sort of unfair. I mean, Rav Moshe was such a towering figure that, like, it's like, you know, time is measured in halachic history as before Rav Moshe and after Rav Moshe. You know, it's like the Posek Hadar before Rav Moshe was Rav Henkin. Who's the Posek Hadar after Rav Moshe? I think we're still looking for him. We're not really sure exactly. You know, Rav Shlomo Zalman and Eretz Yisrael, but like there wasn't, and Rav Eliashiv, but there wasn't really anyone that ever filled Rav Moshe's shoes in America. Meaning, what I mean by that is, when Rav Moshe Feinstein was alive, every shaylit in the world that was important went to him. There's no one in America that happens with that. I mean, if there's a shaila that comes up in Australia or England or whatever, it's going to go to Israel before it goes to America. Meaning there's no one single authority in America that the whole world will turn to for psak halacha automatically. There are, obviously, Rav Shechter gets shailas from all over the world, but it's not an automatic that if you have a shaila, that it must go to a particular address. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was unique in that way, so they always refer to Rav Henkin as the guy before Rav Moshe, you know, the one that was the posek that before Rav Moshe, which is a little unfair because he was a major, major posek in his own right. And it's possible that it's because of his work that Rav Moshe was able to become Rav Moshe in America. It could be Rav Moshe would have arrived to America and there would have been no one here to appreciate him. But because of all the groundwork Rav Henkin laid in developing America and the Torah community in America, there were some people that were ready for Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe refers to Rav Henkin with great reverence many, many times throughout the Igros Moshe. For example, there was a shaila Rav Moshe was asked about an operation that a person wasn't sure if he should undergo. The doctor said, there's a 50-50 chance this operation will kill you. If you don't get the operation, you'll die in 3 months. If you do get it, you'll either die on the table or you'll live for a few more years. So the person wanted to know, should he get the operation or not? What do you say? Again, the choice is, you're either going to die in 3 months automatically, or you'll die, or you'll get an operation where you have a 50% chance that you'll die on the table, that you'll die in surgery. But if you don't die in surgery, and we're actually successful, then you may survive for several more years.
Like a gay Chazi and his sons, when they were in Mitzaras, they went and ran after the army because they thought that they could get food there, and then the army ran away. So.
Right, so sometimes there's a risk that's acceptable, right? That's acceptable to take, even though you might lose now, because there's a long-term reward for it. So Rav Moshe allowed such an operation, and he concludes, you know, after he explains his reasoning, he says, and Rav Henkin agreed to me. He says, look, you're not going to find it in writing from Rav Henkin. He told me that he agrees with me, and I'm writing it based on his request. I'm writing this psak down, which tells you something. It tells you that Rav Moshe, on a major issue, didn't want to paskin without speaking to Rav Henkin first. I mean, that's how big Rav Henkin was. In Yoredeya Chil Gimel Sim Gimel of Igros Moshe, Rav Moshe writes about a shochet who had been behaving improperly, and there was a discussion whether they should suspend him from doing shchita for a while. And Rav Moshe says, yes, he should be suspended from doing shchita, and he should only be reinstated after some time passes. And Rav Moshe writes, Yamod the Mivchan Eitzel Hagon Rav Yosef Elio Henkin Paragashas Pegimo Bidias Hilcha Shchita. We're not going to reinstate the Shochet until he passes the test from Rav Yosef Elio Henkin. Meaning, who did Rav Moshe trust as the person to reinstate the Shochet and say that a guy is good? Rav Henkin. That was the person that he turned to. In Igros Moshe Avnezer Chelik Aleph Siman Lamed, there was a Zakena who had to receive his second get, Misafek. It wasn't clear that the first get she got from her husband was kosher. So in general, the halacha is, if a woman gets divorced, how soon after her divorce is she allowed to get remarried? 3 months, right? You have Gimul Chachay Avchana to make sure that she's not pregnant. Now, it's a low plug. Normally, a Zakena also. Zakena means a woman who's no longer capable of having children. She's too old. It doesn't have to mean like old, but like old enough that she's not going to be able to have children anymore. Nowadays, what Chazal would refer to as a Zakena, we would say is so young, right? Nowadays, if someone dies at the age of 80, we say, oh my gosh, what a young person, right? That they died so young. When I was a kid, 80, we would say, wow, what a long long, full life they live. But thank God, as the years go on, and medicine gets better and better, and with a lot of siyata d'shmaya, the expected lifespan of people is much, much longer than it used to be. So it used to be like a 60-year-old was an old person. So now a 60-year-old is like, you know, running marathons, and like, I don't know, just improved health. They're better, you know, people are in better health for the most part, b'liayin hara. So there was this Akena, but she wasn't going to be able to have children anymore. And she needed a second get. So Rav Moshe allowed her not to wait 3 months for Avchana, and at the end of the tshuva, because it was only get me safek, meaning she was probably divorced already, and at the end of the tshuva he says that Rav Henkin agreed with me about this and therefore I'm comfortable with it. Meaning again, Rav Moshe is saying, I don't want to move without Rav Henkin. He discusses whether you're allowed to open a refrigerator on Shabbos. Why would you not be allowed to open a refrigerator on Shabbos? So we always think of the lights, right? Those anti-Semites who put the lights in the refrigerators, right? It's not about the meaning the lights you could take care of. In the old refrigerators, it was an actual light bulb that you could unscrew. Now it's like LEDs all over the light of the whole thing, and you need like a special Shabbos plug-in, whatever. But in the old days, it was just a regular light bulb, so people would just unscrew the light bulb when they first got the refrigerator and never screw it back in, and that was fine, and the light never turned on. But the other issue is you open up the refrigerator, warm air from your kitchen gets into the refrigerator, the refrigerator senses that, so it immediately gets the motor running again, and you're turning on a motor on Shabbos. So there was a big shaila whether you're allowed to open up a refrigerator on Shabbos. So Rav Moshe writes that Rav Henkin already passed in the shaila that it's mutter to open it up when the motor is already running, and that will just get the motor to run to run even longer. The truth is the topic of the tshuva was about leaving the light on in the refrigerator. But at the end, he just refers to how Rav Henkin already paskin the shayla, and therefore there's nothing to paskin. In another tshuva, Or Chaim Chelkei Simchav, Rav Moshe writes about turning on a hot water tap on Shabbos, that he says, Rav Henkin says, Yesh la hachmir, and therefore people think that he meant that it's only a chumrah, but that really it's mutter. He says, no, I know Rav Henkin. When he said Yesh la hachmir, he meant that it's absolutely forbidden, that we need to be strict about this. Not Yesh la hachmir in terms of chumrah, that it's only a chumrah, right? And come on, Rabbi, don't give me a chumrah, I just want like the halacha. A lot of times people ask shaylas like that, they'll call up, they'll say, I don't want what you really think. I want you to answer the question under the conditions that I'm going to set forth for you. Rav Asher Weiss often complains about this, that people will call him up and say, okay, because he's the great, great posek that everyone turns to, so they want his opinion, but they don't want his real opinion. They want, you know, leave out any chumras, leave out any other considerations. I only want you to paskin the strictest halacha. Rav Asher Weiss says, I tell people when they call me and say that, I will not paskin your shayla. That he just refuses to paskin the shayla. How could he refuse to paskin the shayla? If someone asks a shayla, rabbi's job is to paskin the shayla. It says right there in the smicha, yora, that you're supposed to paskin the shaylas. So Rav Asher Weiss says that no one is, the shoel is not allowed to make the conditions under which I give an answer. I give an answer based on the totality of Torah, the totality of not only the Divrei Torah, but the Ruach HaTorah and the Ratzon Hashem. You have to always have everything in mind. So when Rav Henkin says Yesh Lachmir, he doesn't mean a chumrah. He means that it's not the right thing to do. When asked about the kashrus of a particular bird, Rav Moshe said he wasn't sure, so he consulted with Rav Henkin. And again, in Yardei Chel Gimel Sim Mem Dalet, he consulted with Rav Henkin whether to prohibit hypnosis. You know, that's a tshuva Rav Moshe has about whether you're allowed to do hypnosis. Anyone here ever been hypnotized? Nobody? No one ever, like, was that like a Pesach program where, like, you weren't? It didn't work. No. They put 10 people in a line and they, I don't know. It's not fake. I mean, hypnosis is it's an actual thing. Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Tversky told me once at a Nefesh conference that someone came into his office and he said maybe hypnosis will be helpful for you to clear your mind or focus on whatever. And the guy's like, please, hypnosis, it's fake, it doesn't work. So Rabbi Dr. Tversky said, so I hypnotized him. He said, you know, I said, do you mind if I try? The guy said, yeah, you could try. It's never going to work. He's like, he was actually the easiest subject I ever had. It was like that. The guy was hypnotized. And he said, and while the guy was hypnotized, Rabbi Tversky said, he told the person, every time I stroke my beard, you're going to take your, you're going to stand up from your chair, take your chair and put it up on my desk. And then he snapped him out of the thing, out of the trance. And then he said, how are you feeling? The guy's like, yeah, I'm fine. I told you, it doesn't work. And he's like, really? And the guy starts like moving, like squiggling around, like jumping out of his chair. And he's like, what's the matter? Is everything okay? And the guy's like, did you tell me under hypnosis that I'm going to put my chair on your desk? Yes, I did. So the guy storms out of his office and storms right back in, picks up his chair, puts it on the desk. So ever since I heard that story from Rabbi Dr. Tversky, Zichrono Levracha, I believe that it's not all fake. But so Rav Moshe actually has an interesting discussion about hypnosis, and he said he consulted with Rav Henkin about this, because is a person allowed to give up their Bechira Chavshis? Meaning you're giving up your ability to make choices in life, and you're entrusting it to someone else. So, and sometimes it's for no reason other than for entertainment. And you make an idiot of yourself. You make a fool of yourself. Maybe part of our obligation to safeguard our Tzelem Elokim, 5 points for anyone that could kill that monster that's flying around. Anyone who could safeguard their part of our obligation to safeguard our Tzelem Elokim is to make sure that we live with dignity. So to live an undignified existence is maybe something that we're not allowed to do. Many cases that they agreed about. There's one tshuva in Igros Moshe, or Moshe discusses how to spell Charleston in a get. Meaning people are getting divorced all over the country, and you have to figure out how to, the halachic spelling. So Charles, what Hebrew letters, you know, would make for Charleston, right? So it's not Tez Zayin Shin. It's hard. So exactly how do you spell Charleston? So what was the psak? So I think he said it's somehow he left a shin out. I don't know. I'm not sure why. Somehow he left the shin and his test design. I don't know. But I don't remember what, though. You got to look it up. It's in Igros Moshe, V'ne'ezer, Chelek Aleph, Simen Kuf Lamed Beis. So you look it up, you let me know. So anyway, so I was once at a wedding, and you know, you have the shayla at marriages also, because I had to spell things in a ksuba. It's less important for a ksuba, because if people know what you're talking about, it's good enough. For a get, we're much more careful that everything has to be exact. I was once at a wedding in Tunica, Mississippi. So Tunica, Mississippi. How do you spell Mississippi in Hebrew? So Rav Goldwicht was the Masader Kiddushin at the wedding, and Rav Goldwicht asked Rav Nata Greenblatt, Zichrono Levracha. Rav Nata was the, you know, Rav Nata Greenblatt was. A lot of people had never heard of him until he passed away. Just yeah, Memphis, right? You would know. So Rav Nata was a Gon Adir. He was a Torah giant who, if you saw him, looks like, you know, your great uncle who like barely knows how to read Hebrew, right? If you would see him on the street, right? But he was like a Torah giant. Like he would travel. My brother said that my brother was very close with him. When he would travel, he'd bring along like this. He didn't bring his big talis. He brought like a little scarf talis and like this satin yarmulke. He took off his satin. He had like this tall satin yarmulke that went up to the sky. He looked like a conservative rabbi. You know, it was like, and you know, but not like a contemporary conservative, like a conservative rabbi from like 1955. And but he was just so unassuming. He was a Gon Adir, and he was the address to go to on any issue in Evan Ezer, on Gittin, on Kiddushin, on Chalitza, Yibum. He would perform Chalitza's Baal Peh. He knew the whole procedure of Baal Peh. It was unbelievable. He was an unbelievable person. So anyway, so I was at this wedding in Tunica, Mississippi, and Rav Goldwicht told me that he asked Rav Nata Greenblatt. Rav Nata Greenblatt said that it's Mem Yud, Samach Samach Yud, Samach Samach Yud, Pei Pei Yud, right? That you double all the letters like you do in English. I don't know why that would be the case. But I remember when they read the Ksuba under the Chuppah, they said, Minyan Shana Monim Kan, Tunica, Mississippi, and everyone laughed. Like there was an audible laugh, like, oh my God, we're at a Jewish wedding in Tunica, Mississippi, right? Is there like, are there Klansmen outside? Like what is going on over here? But yes, there was a wedding in Tunica, Mississippi. So anyway, so that's another issue that Rav Henkin and Rav Moshe collaborated on. It's interesting, when you ask about the kashrus of a particular bird, Rav Moshe consulted with Rav Henkin, because for kashrus of a bird, there was a big to-do here on Kolel, when Rav Shechter was here, that someone gave him a locust to eat. So people were very upset by this, that why is Rav Shechter eating locusts? Don't you need a mesorah for a locust? And Ashkenazim don't have a mesorah for locusts. Only certain Sfardim, Temanim, have a mesorah for locusts. So Rav Shachter holds that you're allowed to trust the Temanim mesorah. There's nothing wrong trusting. So it's not so clear that locusts need a mesorah. In Shulchan Aruch it says that locusts either need to be shmo chagav, they either need to be called a chagav, a grasshopper, or they have a mesorah that it's a chagav. But that's all, one or the other. It happens to be, we're machmir that it should have a mesorah, but Rav Shach is making like the sheet of the Shach, that if someone else tells you that they have a mesorah, you're allowed to trust them. With birds, it's not so posh. Birds, absolutely, for Ashkenazim, certainly require a mesorah, right? That's why Rav Shechter will eat a locust, but he will not eat turkey, right? Because a turkey doesn't have a mesorah. The kasha is way better than the answer about turkey. If you try to find where the mesorah came from, meaning where was turkey indigenous to?
Americas.
You know who was here? Native Americans. There was no, we didn't have a Jewish presence here. When Columbus came and sailed the ocean blue, there were some Jewish people on the ship with him. I don't know how from they were. And maybe they started eating turkey, but who gave them the heter to start eating turkey? Like, it's not so possible where the heter comes from. So Shechter won't eat it, right? Meaning most Gedolei Torah do eat it, and the OU gives Hashkacha on it, but Rav Shechter won't eat turkey for that reason. But anyway, okay, so now let's get to the main thing. Okay, we're a half hour in, right? I said we're going to split 50-50. Here's the halachic portion. Rav Henkin's most famous psak was probably his most controversial psak, which is often the way things work, right? His most famous psak was a major machlokas he had with Rav Moshe, but really it wasn't just with Rav Moshe. It was with the entire establishment. It was with the entire, almost every posek in the 20th century disagreed with him about this. And that is, if a couple gets married in a reform marriage or in a civil marriage ceremony, they go to City Hall and they get married. Jewish people, Jewish man, Jewish woman, and they get married at City Hall by a judge saying, I hereby, or a city clerk saying, I hereby declare you man and wife, right? And then a short while later, they get divorced. But they don't get a get, they don't use a get, because they were never really married halachically, so they don't know anything about halacha, so they get divorced legally. And then the woman gets remarried, and she has a child. And the child finds NCSY in his local hometown, and he's very taken by all the madrichim and madrichot and the spiritual atmosphere, and he starts getting firmer and firmer, and now he's a religious boy or a religious young lady, and it comes to light that he or she is the product of a marriage that was the mom's second marriage, and the first marriage never ended with a get. What does that mean? This is a shail of mamzerus, meaning if the first marriage counts as a real marriage, and it didn't, and there was no get given, and then the woman got remarried and had a child, that child is called a mamzer. And that is really, really bad, because that means he can't marry anybody except for another mamzer, and we wouldn't want him to have children, because then he's just going to be marba mamzer and be Israel. So the best thing we can ever say for this child is to say, don't worry, your mom wasn't really married the first time, right? And if she wasn't really married the first time, she just had this relationship with this man, and then she got married to dad, that's okay. So you're born out of wedlock, let's say, but that's not, doesn't make you a mamzer. But if the first marriage was a real marriage and didn't end with a get, he's a mamzer. So this applies to every civil marriage. It was a discussion made every reform marriage, every conservative or many conservative marriages, right? What do you do if there was a marriage but there was no get? One of these types of marriages, if it was an Orthodox marriage and there was no get, that's first of all highly unlikely, because if there was an Orthodox marriage, they probably did an Orthodox divorce, right? But if they did an Orthodox marriage and didn't do a get, then you're really stuck. Then it's real mamzerus. But the shaila is, what if the marriage was questionable? It was a civil marriage, it was a conservative marriage, it was a reform marriage. Do you say that the child is a mamzer?
Wouldn't it seem that the marriage and the get should have the same status? Like why would the get not?
So we'll get to there in a moment. We'll get to it in a... Well, no, they didn't do a get. They got a civil divorce. Oh, why would a civil marriage be better than a civil divorce? Civil marriage is worthless. The question is there something else, because they got civilly married, that we might be able to say they are therefore married? We'll see in a second what that means. Yeah.
Retroactively,
no, it doesn't work that way.
There are times when you give a get or deny where
it has to have been given earlier. Yeah. So here's the issue. Rav Henkin was machmir on this issue. He was machmir that the civil marriage, the reform marriage, the conservative marriage, that they're married, that the couple is married, and therefore if they didn't receive a proper get, the children are mamzerim. Rav Moshe and the entire Orthodox rabbinic establishment, pretty much, not entire, but 90%, disagreed with Rav Henkin about this. What was the basis for Rav Henkin saying that a civil marriage counts for anything? Like you said, a civil marriage should be an absolute zero. So there's a Mishnah in Kiddushin. The very first Mishnah in Kiddushin tells us how marriage works, right? How did anyone ever learn Kiddushin? Three things, right? Kesef, Shtar, and Bia, right? Those are the three ways to get married. Kesef, Shtar, and Bia. How do we do it? Kesef. We do Shava Kesef, right? We use a ring, we do Shava Kesef. Because a ring is worth money, but so it's similar, it's within the category of Kesef. The Gemara already says that it's not such a yeshivish thing to do to get married with Bia, right? That's not the way to do it, right? You don't harayam kadeshesi in front of two Eidim and then take her into a room, right? That's not the way to do things. So the Gemara already says that that's not nice, that, like when you're planning your wedding and you're discussing with your parents what it's going to be like, don't be like, well, I want to do Kiddushi Bia. Like, it doesn't work that way. So the Gemara already says we don't do that. So, but it's a possibility, meaning there is such a thing called Kiddushi Bia. Now, that's Aviv. Next, there is a Mishnah in Maseches Gittin Daf Pei Aleph, where the Mishnah speaks about a couple that got divorced and then slept in the same hotel room together again. They got divorced, and then after the divorce, they slept together. They got divorced, and then they went to the same hotel room and slept in the same room together. So what do we assume about what went on that night? Says the Mishnah, she needs another get. Basila believes that the couple is remarried by virtue of the fact that they stayed in the same hotel room together. What? Where's the marriage? So first of all, we assume that a couple that's already been together and is already comfortable with each other, that if there be yichud overnight in a hotel room, that there must have been bia. And we are all eidim to that, even though we didn't see it with our own eyes, but we saw that they went into the hotel room, we assume that there must have been bia. And second important point over here, a chazaka ein adam osa bi'ilas o bi'ilas nus. That if a person is having bias, they don't want their bias to be a bias nus. What do I look like, a lowlife? I'm going to have a bias nus? No, this is a bias kiddushin. It's kiddushin. They're getting married. So we assume that if a couple sleeps together after they've been divorced, that if a couple is even alone together after being divorced, mistama, they slept together, and mistama, that's a kiddushe bia, because a person wouldn't want to have a bias nus, and therefore you're going to need a second get. That's the Mishnah. That's the Mishnah in Maseches Gittin. Actually had a shaila like this, two shailas like this, actual halacha l'maisa came up. It's a crazy world we live in. I had one case where it wasn't my shaila, it was Rav Asher Weiss and Rav Shechter were dealing with the shaila. I just happened to have been hanging around, you know, when they were dealing with this. I was like one of the couriers in between, you know. So I walked in together with Rav Shai Shechter to Rav Asher Weiss. I brought a bunch of talmidim to Rav Asher Weiss. And Rav Asher said, keep the talmidim outside for a few minutes. So, okay. So they're standing outside in the boiling heat. We're like, okay, nice air-conditioned study here in Brooklyn. So Rav Asher said, I just finished this tshuva. I want you guys to look it over and make sure I didn't miss anything. Like, yeah, like, we're going to correct it? Like, but the shaila was like this. The shaila was that there was a couple that got divorced, right? The divorce settlement was not to the guy's liking. He feels like he got the raw end of the deal in the divorce settlement, but he already gave the get, so it's too late, right? And then the woman was about to get remarried, and a week before her wedding, when she was about to get remarried, the ex-husband called up the officiating rabbi and said to the rabbi, this woman is not allowed to get remarried because I'm married to her. So the rabbi said, what are you talking about? You're the ex-husband, you gave a get. He said, yes, but I moved back into the house for a week. And the Mishnah says in Gittin, Hamagarish is ishto v'lami ima bepundaki, she needs another get. What happened? The guy realized he got a bad settlement agreement, so he called up the ex-wife and he said, "Look, I just don't have any place to stay. We don't have to talk. I just need a roof over my head for a week. I just need a place to be for a week," because he learned in yeshiva. And he learned Tamagarish Sishav Lani Mel Bivuntiki, and he knew that he'll be able to hold her up for whatever settlement he wants if he can stop her from getting remarried. So he didn't learn Musar Seder in Yeshiva, apparently, but he learned Gemara Seder in Yeshiva. So that was the Shaila. So the Shaila, and now he was saying, "Sure, I'll give her a get for $2 million. I'll give her a get, no problem." Or whatever it was, right? So now that the Rav Asher Weiss had to come up, can you somehow overpower this Mishnah? Can you somehow come up with a way where in this case, say he had four tzadim laheter, Rav Asher said a couple of things. He said, first of all, I'm not signing this myself. I want co-signers on this tshuva. So that's where Rav Shechter came in, and that's where Rav Yitzchak Yosef, the Sephardic chief rabbi, also co-signed on the tshuva. Rav Asher wrote it, but they co-signed, they also signed the tshuva. And he said, second, I will not publish this tshuva for 30 years. And even then, I'm going to change details. Because the second I publish it, he's going to bring a rabbi who's going to say that there's a flaw in this argument, that argument. They're going to argue with it. You know, for enough money, you could hire a rabbi who will, who will find all the flaws in your arguments and claim that he knows better than Rav Asher Weiss. And he's just going to cause trouble. So, but he had to be matir. But it's not simple to be matir. I remember that same day, after I brought my talmidim to Rav Asher Weiss, I brought the talmidim to Rav Yisrael Reisman in Torah Vadas. And I told him we were just dealing with this shaila with Rav Asher Weiss. He's like, "I don't know how you can write a tshuva that overpowers a Mishnah." Meaning it's a Mishnah. Like, it's really hard to overcome that. It's a Mishnah. So that was one Maisa. What was the other Maisa I had in mind? No one was reading my mind before. What was it? Daniel, what did I have in mind? Oh, no, there's another one. Also, Magarish Zishta Velani Mabapundagi. He divorced his wife. Oh, this is a little bit of a funnier one. A Talmud of mine, his in-laws got divorced. And let's say they live in an out-of-town place. Let's call it, out-of-town for us New Yorkers means anywhere but New York. So let's say...
Queens.
What?
Antioch as well.
Antioch, yeah. So let's say they live like in some godforsaken place like Queens, right? So like really out of town. I don't know, Great Neck. I don't know, like something really out of town. So someone told me, who just told me, they were talking to someone, and the person said, "Where are you from?" He said, "T-Neck." It's like, "Oh, is that the same as Great Neck?" Like, you think we just call it different things? Like, how would that be the same as Great Neck? But anyway, the in-laws live in an out-of-town community, and they got divorced, which is traumatic for the children, but whatever, okay, they're adults. And they come to visit the in-laws in this out-of-town community, and they go to mom's house, and dad is there. And they're like, "Mom, what's dad doing here?" She's like, "Oh yeah, we got back together again." So he's like, "What do you mean you got back together again?" "Yeah, we were married for 30 years, we got divorced, but we got back together again." "You mean you got remarried?" "No, we just got back together again." Like, they didn't do a kiddushin. They didn't get remarried. They just assumed that, we were married for 30 years, so we could just get back together again. So, like, the guy's freaking out because his in-laws are living together and they're not married. And he's, but they might be, right? So I told him, "You should be Masada Kiddushin right now. Right? Let's do a Kiddushin." Probably can't say a bracha on such a kiddushin, though. Why can't you say a bracha on such a kiddushin? Because they might be married. That's the Mishnah. So it's at least a suffix that they're married. So there is this halach in the Mishnah. Where does this come in over here? Let's say a civil marriage. If you make this assumption that if we know that a couple's been living together, then we know that they've had bia. And you make the assumption that ain't of the most of bilas bilas knows. So Rav Henkin says, just put two and two together. A couple has a civil marriage, then they move into an apartment together. Now you activate what chazaka? And therefore, what's the bia?
Kiddushin.
Guess what? They're married, not because of the civil marriage, but because of the bia that they have is Mishnah Beis Amar Aleph, Kiddushin. That you can be Makadi Shanisha, Bekesa, Bishtar, Ooh, Bibiya. How could Rav Moshe and the whole rabbinic establishment argue on that, right? Good case. I made a good case, right? So that's what Rav Hankin says. So yeah, argue.
Yeah, so don't you need to either say something or have kavanah? And if someone's getting, if like a reformed person's getting married, it's very unlikely that they have kavanah that there'd be a work to make them married.
I don't know if you need to say something. Mishnah just says Megarish is a shuvalani mabibundaki. But meaning you assume the Maisa Bia.
Right, but you said that.
And there's assumed Kavana.
Yeah, there's assumed.
So you're attacking the assumed Kavana.
Yeah,
you're saying, look, you could assume Kavana if it's a frum couple that got divorced and then they go and sleep in the same hotel room. But if it's a couple that was living together for 5 years before they got married and is now living together after they get married, so you can't assume, oh, this is going to be a Bias Kiddushin, that this is going to be a Bias L'Shem Kiddushin.
Why does it matter that they got married now?
Even before they got married, right? I mean, it would be the same issue. L'chora. So it all hinges on this. So the question of civil marriage didn't exist in the times of the Shulchan. We didn't have such a thing. Every marriage was a religious marriage. But what did exist in the times of the Rishonim was a Jew who got married in a Catholic ceremony. Let's say a Jew totally abandoned the religion, got married in a Catholic ceremony, and then lived together. So the Rivash, one of the Rishonim, writes in a tshuva, where he has two major arguments why Jews married in Catholic ceremony are not married according to halacha. Number one, he says that if a couple chooses to get married in a Catholic ceremony, that is as overt and explicit a statement as you could ever have that they do not want to be married al pi Torah. So to make an assumption that I don't want the bia to be a bias nus, I want it to be l'shem kiddushin. They got married in a Catholic ceremony. They're not interested in kiddushin. It's an explicit statement, kimat, that they're not interested in kiddushin. Second of all, says the Rivash, ein adam osa bilas o bilas nos does not apply to people who we know are osa bilas and bilas nos. Right? I mean, if everything you know about them says that they are osa bilas and bilas nos, how can you say ein adam osa bilas o bilas nos? Meaning, for example, does the woman go to the mikvah? Right? If she doesn't go to the mikvah, then what does that make her? Anida. Anida is an Isser Kares. It's probably one of the Arayos. It's an Isser Kares. How severe of an Isser is it to sleep with a girl when you're not married to her, if she's Tahora? Not an Isser Kares. It's bad. You don't get a mitzvah note for it. But it's not an Isser Kares. Anida is an Isser Kares. So you're going to tell me about a person, about a couple, where they violate, he and she, violate Nisr Kares all the time. You're going to say, chazaka, that they don't make a Bila Bila's Nus. That it must be that the Bila's L'Shem Kiddushin. Says Rivash, that's ridiculous. And therefore, and the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah suggest, accept the Rivash. And the Shulchan Aruch says, if you have a man and woman who are forcibly converted and then married in Catholic ceremony, even though everyone, all the Jewish community sees them going into an apartment alone and living together like a normal husband and wife, no kiddushin exists between such a man and such a woman. Black on white in Shulchan Aruch. What?
Is it forced?
Yeah. In the case of the Shulchan Aruch, that was the common case. That's the case Rav spoke about. So Rav Moshe says, okay, now I have it. If a couple gets married in a, what difference does it make to me whether it's a Catholic ceremony, a civil ceremony, or a conservative ceremony, or a reform ceremony? Bottom line is, they're not interested in kiddushin, in a real kiddushin. And if they're not interested in a real kiddushin, then it's going to turn out. If they are halachically observant, so then obviously you're going to require a get. But if they're not halachically observant, and they're also bilas and bilas nus in every other context, so then there's no problem. How could Rav Henkin argue on that? Meaning now we just, right? Now the kasha becomes much, now we have black on white in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says that it was if they got married in a Catholic ceremony, there's no way that they're married. So comes along Rav Henkin and he says that if the couple intends to be married, then every act of bia should be viewed as an act of kiddushin. If they want to be married, if you ask them, are you guys married? And they say, yes, we are married. Then we assume every act of bia is an act of kiddushin. He says you don't have to have intention to marry according to halacha in order for kiddushin to take effect. Meaning, do you need das? Yes. Do you need das that you're getting married al pi the halacha? No. You need das to be married. And if you have das to be married, that la halacha carries the weight of kiddushin. And that's how Rav Henkin argues. What about the Rivash? He said the Rivash was talking about conversos. They explicitly left the Jewish religion. That's a totally different story. That's an explicit statement that they don't want to be married. But short of an explicit, you have people who just don't know anything. So they went to the justice of the peace, or they went to their local reform rabbi, and she officiated the wedding, right? I mean that's not an explicit statement that they don't want anything Jewish. They have a nice ketubah, they, you know, in English and Hebrew and whatever. They just don't read it too carefully, right? I mean that's not an explicit statement that they don't want to be Jewish. So how can you say that they don't want to be Jewish? So Rav Henkin argues that they do want to have a Jewish wedding. And they do want to be married. And as long as they want to be married, that is a Jewish wedding. Now, most reject Rav Henkin.
Just to avoid Mamzer, or because?
No, meaning because they... So what's the Nekudas HaMachlokas? Let's get to it. What's the Nekudas HaMachlokas? The Nekudas HaMachlokas is what creates Kiddushin. Meaning, what makes Kiddushin? Is it intent for a permanent monogamous relationship? Are those words too big for you? Daniel, you got monogamous? Yeah. So a permanent monogamous relationship. That's Kiddushin. That they want to live together permanently with just him, just her, right? They're going to be loyal and faithful to each other till death do you part, you know, whatever they say on TV, right? They're going to be, that's what they're hoping for. Mrs. Kamenetsky told me that once one of her students asked, she was teaching a life cycles class, and one of her students asked, how come in a Jewish wedding they don't stop before the ceremony and say, if anyone has any objections, speak now, forever hold your peace, like they do on television in the non-Jewish ceremonies. Why don't we do that? So what's the answer? Because there's a mother-in-law at every wedding, like no wedding would ever... Okay, anyway, so the issue is that enough to make Kiddushin, the desire to have a permanent monogamous relationship? Or, no, Kiddushin means I want to be married according to Jewish law. So if a couple goes to the civil, you know, to a court or whatever, they want to have a permanent monogamous relationship. Says Rav Henkin, good enough, they're married. Right? Why are they married? Because when they go home together, snap, they're married. According to Rav Moshe, no, they don't want to be married al pi halacha. They're not. Their bia is not a bia l'shem kiddushin. You know why it's not a bia l'shem kiddushin? They think they're married already. You wouldn't have a bia l'shem kiddushin if you think you're already married. You would only have a bia l'shem kiddushin if you think that you're not married, and this is why you need to get married. But if you think that you're married already, then the bia is not l'shem kiddushin. So that's really what this shaila revolves around. And it was a huge machlokas. And I mentioned before, we started by saying how much respect Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Henkin had for each other. And how Rav Moshe, you should realize what a chiddush it is that he quotes Rav Henkin like a dozen times in his tshuvas, if not more. Rav Moshe never quotes contemporaries. It wasn't his style. Unlike Rav Vadi Yosef, who quoted anybody and everybody, Rav Vadi had a photographic memory and read every book that came out. He had the biggest warehouse of Torah knowledge was Rav Vadi Yosef's brain. In history. Because there were just never that many Svarim. And he memorized all of them. It's like mind-boggling. Rav Moshe's style was different. Rav Moshe studied the Gemara, the Rishonim, Shulchan Aruch, the major commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, and he analyzed it and arrived at a Pesach Halacha. Once in a while, he'll quote a Nodeb Yehuda, a Chasam Sofer, Rav Shlomo Kluger, some of the really big names. But other than that, he never quoted people of his own generation. It wasn't his style at all. Quoted Rav Henkin dozens of times. And this became a very, very contentious issue. To the point where Rav Moshe, according to Rav Henkin, Rav Moshe was allowing Mamzerim to get married. Meaning the people that Rav Henkin thought were Mamzerim, Rav Moshe was saying, no, you're good, it's fine. So Rav Henkin thought that Rav Moshe was ruining the Yichus of Klal Yisrael. Which is, what do you do? What do you do if, like, your best friend, who you think is the biggest Talmud Chacham in the world, is making this terrible mistake and is causing Mamzerim to marry into Klal Yisrael? Ah, like Yisrael Vasil, right. So what do you, maybe you won't marry into their family, or what? Do you say something publicly? So Rav Henkin, in a Hapardes journal, Nisan Tavshin Chav Gimel, writes, L'tza'ari, to my great pain, Mukhruch anochi lios bal macha'a al hara aso, I am forced into the position of making a macha'a, an objection, to the Pesach of Rav Moshe, benido nisue arkaos for reforming. in the matter of civil and reform marriages. Shaladaati hu alulasos shamus bi yichus Yisrael levadis ramzerus veishes ish. He says it's going to ruin the yichus of Klal Yisrael. Aside from the fact that you're causing people to violate the Yisrael marrying a mamzer, and you're allowing yeshus ish to marry other men. V'luav a pasuk bal peh hechrashti. Then Rav Henkin shows his hand. He says, if Rav Moshe would have just whispered this to someone in a particular case, I would have kept quiet. Kima kochi, because what am I supposed to do? He's a posek, he's going to say what he's going to say. Avon mikivan sha davar baba sefer, umakolo yagado. But since Rav Moshe published a tshuva, and he publicized this psak, v'isvakeach shav imasha kasafti b'sefer perusha yibra, and he argues on what I wrote in my sefer, I have no choice. I have to make a macha. I have to make an objection. Otherwise, everyone's going to say, oh, Rav Henkin was quiet when Rav Moshe disagreed, so it must be Rav Henkin agrees. So you have to publicize that you can't rely on Rav Moshe. Such a psak is an aveira, and we need to save whoever we can save. And then he writes at the end, "Bitzar miyuchad al mashu ulai yigra mechtav itzar lahadras ga'ona." That I'm writing with great pain. You can feel the warm tears dripping down Rav Henkin's cheeks as he's writing this. He says, "I'm writing this with great pain because I know that this might cause tzar to the great Gaon Rav Moshe Feinstein." But avol melech hashemayim, what am I supposed to do? So that's what Rav Henkin wrote. Rav Moshe wrote back. Rav Moshe went so far as to say that even a reform marriage is not a kiddushin, because there's no anan sahadi that the giving of the ring was a kiddushin, and you know we don't even know what actually goes on under the chuppah. And Rav Henkin responded to that also, and Rav Henkin said, whoa, wait, what are you doing? Reform marriages? He says, v'hafle v'fela mamish tismar saros harosh. He says, my hair is standing up on end. I guess he had hair, not like me. Mashahikil bin Iskachel, if they reform him, he's makel by reform. It's one thing by a civil marriage, by a reform marriage. V'chiyesh tzorech bin Mesarik Kedushin. Wait, you think a Mesarik Kedushin is important to making a Jewish wedding? You know how a Jewish wedding happens? Two Eidim, a Chasen, and a Kala. That's all you need. You don't need a Mesarik Kedushin. Mesarik Kedushin is there to make sure everything goes okay, but it's only two Eidim, a Chasen, and a Kala. So what, because the Mesarik Kedushin wears a talus like a scarf and whatever, so the marriage is not kosher, who cares what the Mesarik Kedushin is? So Rav Henkin can't believe it. He can't believe it. Oddly, many times in the Gemara, Rav Moshe says that when it comes to reform marriages, even Rav Henkin agrees to me. But Rav Henkin wrote what he thought about reform marriages. He says it makes his hair stand up on end to think that it'd be a matter of reform marriages. So anyway, so this was a point of major contention between the two. I believe when Rav Moshe passed away, Rabbi Tendler, Zichron Levracha, in his hesped for Rav Moshe, said that this was the most important psak Rav Moshe had. Because with this psak, Rav Moshe saved thousands of mamzerim. And Rav Moshe's psak is what carried the day. Rav Henkin's psak was largely ignored. I mean, not ignored. Look, if you're able to work out that they can get a get after a civil marriage, you know, that ends, we always try to do that. Everyone tries. Rav Moshe says he's trying to do that also. Rav Moshe was talking about after the fact. They didn't receive a get. She got remarried. They have a kid, so it's too late. Right? But whenever you can get a get, we always try to do that. There are certain exceptions also. If, let's say, a couple lived in a place where Jewish weddings were illegal, so then maybe another must be less no supplies. Meaning they wanted to get married Jewishly, they weren't allowed to. Or you have a case where non-observant, this happens all the time, non-observant couple gets married civilly, then they become Bali Tshuva. And they never think to get married again. So they're living together, and they slowly become frum. So at what point do you say, you know what, we should get married? Right? So sometimes they've been living, they're going to an Orthodox shul, as my brother just had the shayla. They're going to an Orthodox shul, they're keeping kosher, the kids are in yeshiva, and they never got a Jewish wedding. Right, so in that case, it could be that even Rav Henkin would agree that they are married, right? Meaning because Einod the Mosul Bilas Bilas Nus. They do not want, once they're from, they don't want to make Bilas Bilas Nus. But you would still have to do probably another Kiddushin just without a bracha, maybe without a bracha in such a case. Okay, there's a lot more to say, but that is the basics of Rav Henkin, really, and not major machlokas with Rav Moshe Feinstein.